Literally from the North Shore presents Dean Hovey's book Whistling Sousa in 14 episodes. This is episode 6. I pulled myself out of Sheila's aura and pushed my way back to Brian Johnson, who was laughing nearly in tears after watching my introduction to Sheila. "Man, you were lucky to get away with your arm," Brian said quietly. "She hooked onto you like a leech. The look on her face was like she was a mosquito and you were fresh blood." "I think you're mixing your metaphors," I replied, trying to see who Sheila had locked onto after my escape. "Hey, I'm a tuba player. We're allowed great latitude in metaphor mixology." Brian stopped and cocked his head. "I heard you're an Iraq war vet. The VFW bartender told Keith you'd been a Navy corpsman. Is that true?" "I don't have time." Brian smiled. "The bartender also said that you were very humble. I like that in a director." "He said humble?" Brian shrugged. "You don't wear your stripes." "You say that like a Marine," I said. "Two tours in Vietnam, two Purple Hearts. I owe my life to two Navy corpsmen. You guys are almost as crazy as tuba players." The musicians were starting to migrate back to their seats, and he gave me a nudge. "Give 'em hell, Doc." "Doc?" I asked. Every corpsman I knew was nicknamed Doc, just like every electrician is Sparky. Before taking the podium, I rechecked the crowd. Jeremy had a puff of pink cotton candy, and Jenny gave me thumbs up. Mother had found a chair in the back and was gabbing with the stranger seated next to her, waving her arms to accentuate whatever topic she was spouting upon. The second half of the concert flew by. The songs were familiar and the musicians were surprisingly talented. Everyone on stage seemed to be in the groove except Sheila. As we got to the last song, she seemed fidgety and distressed. I tried not to notice, but she rubbed at her throat and chest and she stopped playing before the song ended. She started gathering her music during the last few bars of the song, which was very distracting for the rest of the band. I wondered if this was all part of her routine, arrive late and leave early. She was pushing her way off the bandstand before the last note stopped resonating. I thought she must be having some kind of medical distress, perhaps dehydration or heat stroke. When the concert ended and I had shaken hands with the musicians, Jeremy, Jenny, and her parents discreetly approached the bandstand. My mother pushed her way through the departing crowd with the subtlety of a grizzly chasing a salmon. "Peter, Peter," Mother cried as I were about to slip away without noticing her. I waved discreetly in hope that she might slow the onslaught before she bowled someone over. By the time she reached us, she was breathless. "Oh, Peter," she gasped, "I was afraid that you were going to exit with the orchestra." She embraced me in a smothering hug and then stepped back as if to inspect me. "Mother, while you catch your breath, I'd like to introduce Jenny and her parents, Barbara and Howard Chapman." "Oh, I finally get to meet your little friend Jenny," Mother said, quickly sizing up Jenny, then giving her a bear hug. Mom whispered something in Jenny's ear that resulted in Jenny turning bright red. As Mother stepped back, she said, "Please call me Audrey." After releasing Jenny, she caught a glimpse of Jeremy, who was peeking around Howard, apparently trying to evade the hugging scene. The person hiding behind Howard is Jeremy, Jenny's son. Mother reached out to hug Barbara, who quickly engaged the two extended hands and turned it into a two-handed shake. Barbara managed a Mona Lisa smile that nearly cracked her makeup and said, "It's very nice to meet you." Mother, oblivious to Barbara's hint that Jenny's family might not be the hugging type, grabbed Howard before he had the chance to dodge her. Mother engulfed him in a hug while he held his arms away from her and gave me a pleading look. "Mom, I think it's time to decide where to eat supper." Audrey released Howard and quickly scanned the area for Jeremy. Not wanting any part of the hugs, Jeremy had slipped into a row of folding chairs 20 feet away. He looked like a baseball player getting ready to steal second base with his feet spread wide, ready to dart in any direction that would take him away from Mother. Jeremy, I won't hurt you. I just want to give you a hug. Jeremy shook his head, backed up, and tumbled over a chair. He quickly recovered and moved farther down the aisle. From outside the tent, I heard a commotion and saw a group of people gathering near the back of the bandstand. I heard someone yell, "Call 911, we need an ambulance," and I ran to the gathering crowd. Sheila was on the ground, gasping for air. Her bassoon case and open purse were next to her. Several brown pill bottles were strewn near the bassoon case. She was trying to grasp her purse as I pushed my way through the crowd and knelt next to her. "EpiPen," she whispered hoarsely. I ripped her purse open and rifled through the assorted toiletries, makeup, keys, and writing pens until I found the auto-injector pen filled with epinephrine, used to treat severe allergic reactions. "What allergies do you have?" I asked, as I flipped the cap off the pen. "Nuts," she croaked. I jabbed the pen into her thigh and held it in place to make sure the enclosed, spring-loaded syringe administered the full dose of medicine into her system. "Did someone call an ambulance?" I yelled to the crowd. "They're coming," a male voice responded from the rear. Sheila continued having breathing problems. I had nothing else to offer except soothing words that I hoped were encouraging. Jenny pushed in next to me and took Sheila's pulse. "She has a nut allergy, and I injected her EpiPen," I explained. Jenny picked up the auto-injector and inspected it. "This expired a year ago, and it's only a 300 microgram dose. Sheila, is there another EpiPen in your purse?" I again rummaged through the contents of Sheila's purse, but didn't find another pen. Sheila was shaking her head, apparently unable to speak. She didn't have another pen. "Does anyone have an EpiPen?" Jenny asked the crowd. Sheila was in severe respiratory distress. Her lips were swelling, and she was struggling to draw a breath as her throat swelled. There was no response to the EpiPen request from the accumulated crowd, and it appeared that Sheila's expired pen wasn't giving her any relief. I could hear a siren whine nearby. "Have you ever done an emergency tracheostomy?" Jenny whispered in my ear. "If her throat continues to swell, she'll die if we don't open her trachea." I've never even seen one performed except on television. I flashed back to a scene of carnage in Iraq. On my first mission, an IED exploded, throwing a Marine against the Humvee's steering wheel, crushing his larynx. I'd pulled him from the scene and done the tracheostomy as he passed out. It was my baptism under fire. Sheila was grasping for air, and I prayed she would continue to get enough oxygen to stay lucid. "Coming through," I heard the shout from the outskirts of the crowd. Len Rentz, the police chief, opened a lane through the onlookers, leading an EMT who was carrying an oxygen bottle and green face mask. Jenny assisted the EMT by putting a green plastic mask over Sheila's nose while explaining that we'd injected an EpiPen. Sheila didn't respond to the treatment, and her breathing became increasingly labored. I let Jenny and the EMT take over gathering the contents of Sheila's purse from the ground and repacking them. I heard the rattle of a gurney rolling over the rough ground and saw the second EMT and a deputy sheriff push through the crowd. Within moments, Sheila was strapped to the gurney and rolling toward the ambulance. Jenny and I were drenched with sweat as we picked up Sheila's purse, the pill bottles, and bassoon case. Len Rentz was at my side. "What happened?" Len asked. "Sheila appeared to have an allergic reaction," I replied. "She has a nut allergy." "Allergic reactions like that can come on very quickly," Jenny said. "She's been performing for almost an hour. I think that she must have eaten a nut during the concert." Len looked around the immediate area, and within 100 feet there were three vendors selling roasted peanuts, nut-covered caramel apples, and funnel cakes, probably fried in peanut oil. "Looks like there are plenty of places she could have contacted nuts." "But she knew she had an allergy," Jenny said. "She wouldn't eat something like that on purpose. She must have had a serious reaction sometime in the past to get a prescription for an EpiPen, and anyone with a serious allergy becomes paranoid about their food choices and even preparation. After what I sometimes called a blinding flash of the obvious, I set the bassoon case on the ground and opened it, searching for the vials with the wetted reeds. I found all three pill bottles, or reed cases, and opened the first, pouring out the reed and clear water into my hand. The second didn't have a reed, but as I poured out the water, half a peanut tumbled from the vial. The reed from that case was obviously the one still on the bassoon's metal crook. Peter, if you suspected that someone had dropped a peanut into the pill bottle, why did you pick it up and get your fingerprints all over the surface? Len scolded. He pulled a pair of blue surgical gloves from a pocket and slipped them on before taking the bottle and peanut from me. I felt the red creeping up my face. Sorry, it was just a hunch and I wanted to check it out. See if the musicians are around, he said. I'd like to talk to them. Maybe one of them saw someone messing with the bottles. My mother, never the shrinking Violet, pushed past Len and looked at us. I became aware of my sweat-stained shirt and the grass and gravel ground into the knees of my pants. Peter, how do you expect to eat at a nice restaurant dressed like that? Peter just saved a woman's life, Jenny said quietly. Mother looked at her, noting her sweaty cotton blouse and the sand on her knees. Well, did he have to be so messy doing it? Jeremy pushed past Jenny's parents and sidled next to Jenny. He gave me a knowing look and said, It was just like when you took the gun away from that crazy woman who was shooting at us. Cool. You just ran to where the trouble is and take care of it. I could see that I'd won a few points with Jeremy, but Mother wasn't persuaded. Peter is always getting himself in the middle of something, and I'm afraid he sometimes just doesn't show due consideration for others. I'm afraid our dinner plans are ruined. As she spoke, she was gesturing wildly, making the bangles on her wrists sound like a bunch of cymbals. Len, who I've known for years, was straining to keep a straight face. I have a clean shirt in my car, I said. I'll change on the way to the restaurant. Is it the hideous Hawaiian shirt you wore to the funeral last spring? Len asked, trying to add fuel to the fire. I closed my eyes and waited for the next eruption from Mother. The shirt was indeed a Hawaiian-style shirt, but was more seasonally correct now than at the spring funeral, and probably coordinated with Mother's multicolored caftan. Peter wore a Hawaiian shirt to a funeral? Mother asked. I steered her toward the parking lot. I broke my nose right before the van left for the funeral, and I had blood all over my white shirt, so Wendy, the girl who has the band I spoke about, loaned me a Hawaiian shirt she'd worn to a luau-themed party. I continued the story all the way to the parking lot where everyone dispersed to their cars. At the edge of the parking lot, we stopped to make plans. We'll eat at Nokomis, that restaurant on the road to Duluth, Mother announced. They have a nice menu, and it will be halfway to my house. Would anyone like to ride in the convertible with me? Jeremy raced off to ride with my mother in a red Cadillac convertible, and Jenny's parents walked to their Buick. I pulled the sweaty golf shirt over my head and mopped my face with it as Jenny took the Hawaiian shirt off the hanger in the back seat of my old Corolla. Jenny gave me a hug after the shirt was on and stretched up to kiss me. The concert was really good. Thanks, the musicians are great, and I'm really pleased they asked me to conduct. Do you know what your mother asked me? Jenny asked as we got in the car. Well, you blushed, so it had to be something very personal. Let's see, did she ask if you were really blonde? Worse. I shuddered at the thought that Mother would ask my girlfriend something even more tasteless than if her hair color was natural. I give up. What did she ask? Jenny faced away from me and looked out the side window. She asked what type of birth control I'm using. She really asked that? I almost shouted, knowing full well that Mother's mental filter didn't stop a lot of nosiness. Jenny nodded assent. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 14. The Nokomis Restaurant, overlooking Lake Superior and located between two harbors and Duluth, was above my budget. We followed the convertible with Jeremy in the passenger seat with the bill of his cap facing backwards. Every time he looked back at us, he had an ear-to-ear grin. Despite the lovely view of the lake, dinner was a nightmare. My mother talked endlessly about her charity work. Jenny's mother listened politely and nodded at appropriate points in the conversation. Jeremy talked about riding in the convertible with the top down and suggested that everyone in the family get one just like it. He also regaled my mother with the story of the crazy woman who lives next door to me who tried to shoot rabbits from her back porch. Mother thought he was fabricating a tale, and no one argued the point. Jenny was still trying to figure out the whole issue of Mother's question about contraceptives. A huge argument broke out when the check arrived. Mother scooped the folio out of the waiter's hand and jammed her Amex card into it before anyone could react. Jenny's father tried to intercept the waiter, but Mother made such a scene as only she can that his Scandinavian predisposition to avoid arguments at all costs overrode his generosity, so he let Mother pay, but was obviously smoldering. Mother was oblivious to his displeasure and went on with her discussion about raising funds for an endowed chair at the University of Minnesota Medical School to study post-traumatic stress disorders in returning Iraq War veterans, an issue that had been in the headlines since the first Iraq War. You know, it's something that might help Peter if he'd ever admit he has PTSD, Jenny said. I almost choked on my last bite of cheesecake. Jenny's father turned and asked, "You were in Iraq?" Mother started to expound on the number of Iraq War vets with PTSD, apparently not picking up on Jenny's comments when Jenny did something terribly out of character. She put her hand on Mother's arm and raised her finger. Mother sat frozen. "Daddy, Peter was a Navy corpsman in Iraq. He was wounded and was awarded a Purple Heart and Bronze and Silver Stars for bravery." Mother's eyes shot to me and her mouth fell open. She had never asked what I'd done in the Navy. She'd been too busy with her own projects to inquire about my military experience and probably assumed I'd been floating the oceans of the world on a ship. Jenny's father was seated across from me, and when he stood, I wasn't sure if he was going to walk out or punch me. Instead, he reached across the table and shook my hand. "Thank you," he said. "This country owes a great deal to people like you." Jeremy whooped, "Peter's a hero," which turned heads at neighboring tables. I turned red, excused myself, and escaped to the restroom. Inside, I leaned against the cool wall tile and closed my eyes. A toilet flushed, and I jumped, seeing a Humvee rolled on its back like a turtle. Memories of injured Marines and endless dusty roads with danger in every rock pile flowed freely. Memories I'd buried and hoped to never see again spilled out as the occupant of the toilet stall washed his hands and dried them. "Are you okay, son?" I opened my eyes to a white-haired gentleman looking at me with concern. "I'm fine. I just had a little surprise," I said. He nodded and walked out. A second later, I heard the creak of the restroom door and a quiet voice asked, "Peter, are you okay?" Jenny's father was standing inside the door. "Just catching my breath," I said, taking a deep breath and straightening up. "I have to say I owe you an apology." "Well, why?" I asked. "I thought you were this big, dopey, guitar-toting hippie who was taking advantage of my daughter." He stopped for a few seconds, considered his words, and added, "I guess I couldn't have been more wrong. Will you forgive me?" "I don't think you need to apologize," I said. "I've been living in my own little world, and I hadn't considered what impression I was leaving with you and Barbara." "Jeremy thinks the world of you," he said with a smile. "Maybe I should have trusted his judgment more than mine." He took my elbow and steered me out the door. Sensing that my military past was causing problems for me, he changed the topic. Tell me about your crazy neighbor who was shooting in her backyard. Jeremy said you threw him to the ground and shielded him when you heard the shots. We talked about the bunny incident as he led me back to the table where everyone was preparing to leave. At the table, Jenny's father walked my mother and hugged her. You must be very proud of your son. He's an extraordinary person. I can never recall a previous time when my mother was speechless. Jenny walked me to my car and gave me a quick kiss. I think this went pretty well, she said, holding my hand. And you were so apprehensive about our parents' meeting. Well, it's certainly a day I won't soon forget. I should ride home with Mom and Dad now, she said, looking back at our mixed family group who were saying their goodbyes quietly in the parking lot. I thought Jeremy had a sleepover and you were spending the night at my house. Jenny looked at the body language of our parents and Jeremy, then gave me a chaste kiss. I think I'd better spend the night with my folks. Whistling Sousa, Chapter 15, Sunday. I was in my tiny office, sipping from my first cup of coffee, when I caught the scent of pipe tobacco. I didn't need to turn to know who was at the door. "Hi, Len," I said. "Once again, you ran to the emergency and came through," he said, pulling a pipe from his pocket and filling the bowl with honey Cavendish tobacco. "What emergency?" I asked. "Sheila O'Keefe survived her allergic reaction. I talked to her in the hospital this morning, and she's going to be released as soon as the doctor makes his rounds. She told me to thank you." "I'm happy to hear she's bouncing back so quickly," I said. "She'd like to thank you in person." I flashed back to Brian Johnson's comments about Sheila's questionable ethics. "I'm sure I'll run into her in town." Len put the pipe stem in his mouth and patted his pockets, looking for a lighter. "She was very sick when she got to the hospital. The ER doctor said if you hadn't stuck her with the EpiPen, there's a good chance she would have died." "I'm glad she had one in her purse." When Len pulled a lighter from his pocket, I added, "You know you can't smoke in here." Len sighed and put the lighter away. Sheila also told me that she'd left the reed cases next to her chair during the intermission when she bought a bottle of water, so anyone on the stage could have dropped a peanut into the case. "Somebody who knew she had an allergy wanted to scare her," I said. "She could have gone into anaphylactic shock and died. The county attorney says he might consider filing a charge of attempted murder." "It might have been a sick prank gone wrong," I replied feebly, not wanting another murder investigation anywhere near me. "It might have been put there by someone trying to kill her." "Why are you telling me?" I asked, with the sinking feeling I knew the answer. "The doctor said Sheila's peanut allergy is so severe she was exposed to the peanut less than an hour before her collapse." I quickly did the math while Len waited, knowing he'd piqued my interest. "She came in contact with the peanut during the concert." My mind was reeling, recalling the mix of musicians shuffling around the crowded bandstand during the intermission. I tried to envision the activity around the area where Sheila had been seated. "Maybe it fell in by accident," I suggested. "She capped the reed case. Was anyone from the crowd on the bandstand during the intermission, or only the band?" Len asked. "I don't remember seeing anyone except the band there. It was already crowded with musicians, and I can't imagine anyone else coming up there." "Then I guess our culprit is a musician," Len concluded. "Len, I know where this discussion is going, and I don't know any of the musicians well enough to be of any help." Len smiled. "I interview people I don't know in every investigation. Why should you be different?" "The first reason is, I'm not a cop. Secondly, I don't want to be a cop." "Okay, you're not a cop, but you are the best trained witness at the scene of the crime." "I talked to the tuba player through nearly all of the intermission," I said. I'm unaware of anything else that happened. Great start, Len said. We've eliminated the tuba player as the assailant. Who else can we rule out? That's a first, a voice came from behind Len, just before Brian Johnson peeked over Len's shoulder. The tuba player is always the prime suspect. Brian stuck his hand out and introduced himself to Len. Hey, do you guys know the range of a tuba? It's about 20 yards if you get a tight-fitting potato. Brian laughed at his own joke. I grimaced. Ah, the tuba player, Len said. Brian handed me a manila folder. Hi, Doc. I have to run, but here's the music for Thursday's concert. I grabbed Brian's hand and pulled him into the office. Close the door, Len. As Brian and I got past our first uncomfortable exchange, he's loosened up and I thought of him more and more as an interesting and funny guy. During the concert, I'd look back at him, swaying along with the rhythm of a waltz with his eyes closed, playing the notes from memory. I could almost envision him in lederhosen and a Tyrolean hat. Brian, since we've eliminated you as a suspect in Sheila's incident, I thought we could pick your brain, I said, clearing the one office chair and almost pushing him into it. Whoa, Doc, he exclaimed. If the hot lights come on, I'm out of here. You probably saw that Sheila had a severe allergic reaction and collapsed after the concert last night, Len said. I saw her on the ground, but I didn't know what was happening, Brian replied. It looked like Peter and his girlfriend had things under control, so I didn't want to stick my head in. Sheila's allergic to nuts, and someone put a peanut in her reed container, I said. Brian looked back and forth between Len and me, apparently searching for a punchline. You guys are serious? He asked. She nearly died, Len explained. Yikes, I know she rubs a lot of folks the wrong way with her chronic tardiness, but killing her off? Brian shook his head in disbelief. Well, that's way over the edge. Did you see anyone tampering with her reed containers? Len asked. They were little brown pill bottles with pop-off white lids. Brian wrinkled his nose. You know, I just kind of sit in the back row and let things go by. Sometimes I joke around with the trombones and drummers, but I'm pretty much always in the back row. Peter and I were talking for a while during the break, and then I told a couple of tuba jokes to the trombone players. Say, how does a tuba player... Not now, Brian, Len said. Is there someone who's been very angry with Sheila? The whole band is mad at Sheila. She's always late and makes us all wait while she gets settled and tunes. Worst of it is, she seems to revel in the attention, even if it's negative. Have there been any specific incidents where band members were angry? Anything out of the ordinary? Len asked. I saw a twinkle in Brian's eye and braced for another tuba player joke, but he surprised me when he said, Sheila took Brandy Childer's music stand during the Memorial Day concert, so Brandy had to share the second chair music with Sue Katowski. Brian, I said, I don't think that Brandy would kill Sheila over a music stand. I agree, but Len asked if anything out of the ordinary happened. All of the other stuff is ordinary. The past 2 weeks' episodes of this program can be listened to from the ktwh.org website. Simply click on Literally from the North Shore from the program's drop-down menu found at the top of the homepage to listen to the archived shows.